the younger kids, you can get them hooked. And once they get up there in age, then they kind of lose interest.
The tough work of bringing a language back from the brink. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new energy efficiency recommendations for the state, including establishing a statewide energy code.
It's really setting a standard, and that's one of the most cost-effective things we can do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
The Alaska Supreme Court says the candidate filing deadline for the August primary will remain June 1st. The court this afternoon denied a Democratic Party petition to delay the candidate filing deadline for 2 weeks. In a petition filed yesterday, ADP Director Kay Brown said multiple redistricting plans have created uncertainty over new district lines. The Alaska Supreme Court last week threw out the redistricting board's latest plan and adopted the April 5th version. The ruling came just 10 days before the June 1st candidate filing deadline. Brown said that was not enough time for candidates to evaluate the election district and get their paperwork to the division. State Elections Director Gail Fanumiai has said no deadlines needed changing because the division mapped each scenario as it was released by the redistricting board. She said precinct boundaries for the April 5th plan have already been drawn. The chair of the Anchorage Assembly has appointed a new municipal clerk. Barbara Jones, who is currently the municipal ombudsman, will fill the position beginning July 1st. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
She has years of experience working within the municipality, and Anchorage Assembly Chair Ernie Hall says that's the reason he appointed Barbara Jones as the new clerk. Hall made the announcement Wednesday.
The thing that made Barbara Jones particularly attractive to the Assembly is the fact that she's been within municipal government for 13 years. She knows the players. She knows how municipal government works.
Jones currently works as the municipal ombudsman and previously worked for 12 years as the executive director and staff attorney for the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission. She'll replace Barbara Grunstein, who served as clerk since 2003. Grunstein resigned last week after several weeks of scrutiny following the flawed April election. More than half of precincts ran out of ballots, and some voters said they were denied the right to vote. The Anchorage Assembly has appointed a retired judge to pinpoint what went wrong during the election. His report, due out by June 28th, will be used as a guide to improve future elections. Jones will make $105,000 a year. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
In the Aleut community of St. Paul, efforts to revive Unangam Tanu have been ongoing for decades. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports on the challenges of bringing a language back from the brink of extinction.
At 86, Ludmilla Mandrigan still vividly remembers the punishment for speaking Aleut in school.
Don't spit it, they say. Phillips Matthews, wrong soap. It had a lie in it, we didn't know.
When Mandrigan had children, she vowed they wouldn't suffer the same abuse.
I speak English only to them. And then when they start teaching Aleut, they said, Mom, can we go to Carson? No kid of mine going to learn to speak Aleut.
Today, Mandrigan is one of only 24 fluent Aleut speakers in St. Paul, even though the community's population is predominantly Unangan. She's no longer opposed to teaching kids Aleut, but she recognizes that it might be too late.
Hardly anybody to speak Aleut with now. When somebody asks me, sometimes I forget the names of things, you know.
In this fourth grade class at the St. Paul School, Edna Floyd's students are reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in Aleut. The dozen kids are still mostly at the beginner level.
Okay, happy birthday.
Yes, say it again. Okay, all of you say it.
The students work their way through a list of vocab words, translating from English to Aleut and then from Aleut to English. Floyd says the progress is slow because she only sees the kids twice a week for 40 minutes. She wishes the community had an immersion program, but...
I don't know how that would work. You'd have to have people that are, you know, willing to work and speak Aleut all the time to the children. So.
I mean, are there enough teachers even possibly do that?
No.
Floyd herself is done teaching. After 27 years, she's retiring from the Pribilof School District. She wishes she'd been able to do more.
The younger kids, you can get them hooked. And, you know, once they get up there in age, then they kind of lose interest.
Over the years, Floyd says she's only had two students really pursue Aleut beyond the elementary level.
And they're both gone now. But they knew a lot. I mean, they could speak and, you know, did real well. But usually once they get out, then that's it.
Floyd says that's because there are so few opportunities to use the language outside of the classroom. Most of her students' parents and often even their grandparents don't speak Aleut. To stay fluent herself, Floyd talks frequently with Ludmilla Mandragon, the elder we heard earlier.
She calls me and talks to me in Aleut, you know, tells me all these stories, you know, where if she were to say it in English, we would lose a lot of meaning.
Whether anyone will be able to understand those stories in 50 years is still an open question for Floyd.
I know it's being worked on, but it has to be fast.
There are only about 100 fluent speakers of Aleut left in the world today, and most are elderly. But the language might not end with them. Some native groups are taking steps to develop a digital language program so Aleut can be passed to future generations, even after the last teachers are gone. Reporting in St. Paul, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Governor Sean Parnell signed a bill yesterday to create the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council. Parnell spoke about the importance of the bill in Dillingham.
We know that without language preservation, a culture dies. That is intolerable. That is not acceptable. And as Alaskans, we honor and celebrate our traditional cultures. And today we do this by assuring that the state is now all in making sure that these languages live on.
The council is tasked with advising the governor and legislature on projects and policy for language preservation and revitalization. The council will be made of five language experts named by the governor. The leaders of the House and Senate will nominate two Bush legislators as non-voting members. A broad coalition of Native organizations came out to support the bill. Nelson Ungapuk is Senior Vice President for the Alaska Federation of Natives.
The foundation of any society is their language. And that's our hope, is that this is what it's going to do, is to preserve not only our languages, but the foundation of our cultures.
Inupiaq and some Athabascan languages are classified as severely endangered by UNESCO. A number of Aleut and Southeast languages are critically endangered, and the Eyak language lost its last remaining fluent native speaker in 2008. The council's first report is due in 2014. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the King Salmon Opener brought out anglers, but not many fish.
This little river got discovered and it got loved to death. So many people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Governor Parnell today signed one of the most far-reaching bills of this year's regular session, a large package of four separate pieces of legislation that were combined in the closing hours. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The subjects of the bills ranged from the movies to oil and gas drilling in rural Alaska. What they had in common was tax and credits. The movie bill was introduced in the Senate by Anchorage Democrat Johnny Ellis as a continuation of an incentive program designed to encourage producers to make more movies and television programs in the state. He wanted to give Hollywood-minded Alaskans the opportunity to work locally in their chosen industry. Anchorage Republican Mia Costello says her subcommittee in the House added one more element that overcame much of the opposition the measure had attracted.
We Alaskanized it by saying that your tax credit is going to be directly tied to the Alaskans that you hire and the Alaska businesses that receive your business. And so any credit for producers, directors, writers will be dependent on how many Alaskans are hired within the whole for the whole film.
While it was in the House, though, a separate bill by Costello was added giving tax incentives to small businesses. Costello says it's the first program of its kind in the nation to offer state incentives to specific, small, high-tech businesses called 1202C corporations. She says it dovetails with the Federal Economic Stimulus Program and is the type of industry Alaska wants to attract.
This bill says if you are one of those companies that qualifies under the federal law, then we would like you to come to Alaska, and if you do, we'll exempt you from our corporate income tax until you grow big enough. And we decided to match the federal definition, which is $50 million in gross aggregate assets.
Costello says the federal program is directed at the software, video game, and biotech industries, as well as media storage servers, superconductors, telecommunications in general. She says there are a few existing businesses already in Alaska that could qualify for the incentive, but the bill was written to attract new investment. Two other measures were added to the same bill number before it finally passed, both by Fairbanks Republican Representative Steve Thompson. He had introduced them to address energy needs in Fairbanks, but expanded them when he saw interest from other parts of the state. Thompson says the so-called Middle Earth Petroleum Production Tax Plan sets a 7-year, 4% limit on oil and gas taxes from fields surrounding 6 specific geographic areas between Cook Inlet and the North Slope.
These remote areas, most of them are close to rural villages that are way too expensive for energy, electric, and for heat. So these have the possibilities of helping remote areas with their high cost of energy.
The other bill from Thompson would originally have paid 50% of the cost, up to $15 million, for a 1 million gallon gas storage tank in Fairbanks. However, Thompson says other communities liked the idea, and the plan was revised to include tanks as small as 25,000 gallons. He says he got positive responses from small communities across the state.
It did gain a lot of traction and interest. And, that one was, again, just started out as trying to give relief to Fairbanks, but figured out how it could possibly help the rest of the state at the same time.
Thompson's finishing his freshman term in office. He said assembling all the elements of this large bill was like a chess game, starting with an incentive for movie production and ending with hopes for gas production in places like Sillowick. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The Cold Climate Housing Research Center has reworked its energy efficiency policy recommendations to the state. The report, released last week, details how the state can cut its total energy use by 15%. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, that kind of cut could save the state more than $850 million by 2020.
The Alaska Legislature and Governor Sean Parnell set a goal in 2010 to improve energy efficiency statewide by 15% over the following decade. John Davies calls that goal aggressive.
Some people say, well, 15%, that's a tiny amount. You know, it ought to be 50%, you know, and I totally agree it ought to be 50%. But typically other states have done something on the order of 1% per year, which would translate into 10% in 10 years, roughly.
Davies is an energy policy researcher at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks. Along with co-author Catherine Dodge, Davies reworked a set of recommendations CCHRC originally made to the state 4 years ago.
The first of the specific recommendations is to keep doing what we're doing. We actually have a lot of great programs in place. The legislature and the governor have put forward these programs, and we're making a lot of progress with those. So it's like the Hippocratic Oath, it's do no harm. You know, keep doing the stuff that's working.
The recommendations don't outline methods for energy conservation. Instead, Davies says they focus on energy efficiency. Davies says Alaska is headed in the right direction, but he says the state can do more.
The top next recommendation was to establish a statewide energy code. It's really setting a standard, and that's one of the most cost-effective things we can do.
Alaska's annual energy expenditure is about $5.7 billion, which does not include jet fuel or oil and gas processing. A 15% decrease in energy use could save the state roughly $855 million.
The per capita savings, should we reach our goal of a 15% cut by 2020, mm-hmm. would be roughly $1,200. That's like a PFD.
Right. Well, it's the same size, okay? But I want to caution that it's not an additional $1,200 in every individual's pocket, because that's also taking into account the savings that there are at businesses and other commercial levels and state government levels. In effect, there's kind of a trickle-down or spread-out effect in the whole economy that's equivalent to that.
Davies plans to take CCHRC's report on the road to push for the formation of a new state commission that would set energy use goals and measure statewide progress.
Sometimes I characterize it as going on the rubber chicken circuit. You know, it's just going out and talking to as many people as you can and trying to find the champions for what we're proposing and seeing if we can actually get real progress to happen. We need to get agencies to start doing some of these programs. We need to get the legislature to fund some of these things. We need to get the legislature to change the law to allow certain things to happen. So we're going to work on all of those fronts. We're going to be busy.
The report was funded by the Alaska Energy Authority and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, as well as the U.S. Department of Energy. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Golden Valley Electric Association is trying a new avenue to secure an air quality permit for the Healy Clean Coal Plant. GVEA Vice President of Resource Development Jean Terrio says the utility is working directly with the federal government to appease environmental concerns.
We're hopeful that it is a way around the existing opposition to the permit renewal.
The state approved an air quality permit for the long-dormant Healy facility more than a year ago, but four environmental groups, including the Northern Alaska Environmental Center in Fairbanks and the Denali Citizens Council in Healy, sought Environmental Protection Agency review. That led to negotiations between the groups and the utility. Terrio says Golden Valley is now working with the EPA on additional emissions controls as a compromise. Northern Center Director Karen Kelly says the deal being worked out between EPA and Golden Valley is an acceptable solution.
All of our colleagues would probably prefer to see this plant never open. However, it's a complicated issue. The price of fuel and the price of electricity here in Fairbanks and in the interior, they're high, and if Golden Valley says that opening this plant is going to lower the price of fuel, that's a good thing.
GVEA's Terrio estimates it will take 1 to 2 years to bring the Healy Clean Coal Plant online, depending on the level of emissions controls included in an agreement with the EPA.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Last weekend was the king salmon opener on the Nanilchik River. Yesterday, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced new restrictions for the river after seeing lower than expected escapement numbers for kings. Beginning June 2nd, only one unbaited artificial lure will be allowed while sport fishing on the Nanilchik and Anchor Rivers and Deep Creek. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran visited the Nanilchik last weekend. He reports the fishing was slow, but for the locals, opening weekend is about a lot more than just catching fish.
Despite this year's lower than average outlook for king salmon fishing around the state, opening day saw plenty of eager anglers waiting for this year's first bite. Among those dotting the banks and shallow, clear waters of the Nanilchik River were the men of the Demers family, Greg and his two sons Coulter and Tristan, and their longtime fishing buddies Wes Coons and Cody Weiss. I caught up with them all Saturday morning when they were into hour number 7. As I spoke with each of them, a couple of observations remained consistent. Over the years, they've seen fewer fish and more people, but even so, being on the river for opening weekend is a long-held tradition.
There's a lot more people in general than there used to be. This little river got discovered, and it got loved to death. So many people.
That was Greg Demers. He spent a career as a biologist with Fish and Game and now spends his summers enjoying the river more than studying it. As we stood and talked in the slow-moving water, the conversation turned to those rather meager numbers projected this year by Fish and Game for King Salmon. And again, Greg pointed to the fact that more people are on the river and taking advantage of local guide services and sport fishing opportunities.
I have a lot of friends that are in the business, and so it hurts me to say that, you know, because I know that individually they're good, responsible people and all that, but they're pretty damn effective at killing fish. When that industry is allowed to expand without regulation, it's like any other industry, you know, when you're depleting a natural resource. So it's like salmon are fighting a losing battle.
Just then, another salmon lost the battle.
What's up? Tristan!
Get some? Tristan's got one! Oh, my brother's got one. Just come down here.
We fished here last night at midnight and didn't touch a thing in this very hole. And then came down first light. Within 15 minutes, we got two.
Right on.
So.
That catch went to Greg's son, Tristan, who works as a commercial fisherman for most of the year. He'd had mixed results to that point, with some good bites early, then nothing until that jack came along. He and his brother Coulter have spent their entire lives fishing the Danilchik and other rivers on the southern peninsula. For them, it's less about the thrill of the hunt and more about being with friends and family. Here's Coulter.
Not only this river my whole life, I grew up, we're at the pavilion up there, you know, pavilion campsite. My brother, that guy Cody right there, he's my neighbor in Hidden Hills, Anchor Point. We all grew up at camping at that pavilion, and now we get it like every memorial. Right on. Kind of a ritual.
At the end of the day, all seemed to agree that regardless of the final bag count, what was most important was being on the river and making sure that the river is always healthy enough to fish, a point made clear as I helped Coulter with a refill.
I'm going to turn that in my back.
You bet.
Need another? By the way, never litter on my river.
Not ever.
That's one of my biggest pet peeves.
Need a refill? You good?
Yeah.
Yeah, sir.
And what's it like to get that first bite of the year?
You can try to describe it, but, you know, it's really exhilarating. It's exciting as hell, you know what I mean? And that's fun, because you get a big fish like that running around these corners, and, you know, you're chasing them down the river and fighting them, and it's really fun.
Reporting from the Danilchik River, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The Environmental Protection Agency is holding a public hearing in Seattle tomorrow on the risk assessment the agency recently released looking at how mining could impact the Bristol Bay ecosystem. It's the first in a series of meetings that will continue in Alaska next week. Ashley Ahern reports the Seattle-based fleet is watching the process closely.
Yeah, let's run it outside all the way down.
Fisherman's Terminal in Seattle is all a bustle this time of year. Bearded, weathered-looking men are checking nets, sanding down hulls, and climbing around on boats. They're getting ready to make the trip to the rich salmon fishing grounds of Alaska. They've done this for decades. Ray Forsman and Jason Lake are reconnecting steering lines on Forsman's ship, the Silver Isle. It's a 60-foot fishing vessel that'll be heading to Alaska in the coming days.
I'll look in the engine room and see. I don't think there's any obstructions right there.
Jason Lake doesn't miss a beat when I ask him about the Pebble Mine, the one that could be built near Bristol Bay. He's been fishing there for 25 years.
No, they put that mine in. It's going to be the worst thing for Bristol. You know, look at what every other mine's done. So it's just a sad deal.
Lake's not alone in his concerns. Fishermen around the Northwest fear mining in that pristine watershed could destroy salmon spawning habitat and hurt their industry. Nearly 1,000 Washingtonians hold commercial fishing permits in Bristol Bay, bringing in over $100 million a year in revenue to the state. Sport fishermen in Oregon and Washington bring in close to another $100 million each year from fishing in the Bristol Bay watershed. That's prompted politicians in both states to call on the Environmental Protection Agency to step in. And the EPA listened. The agency just released a report that's over 1,000 pages long and assesses risks to 20,000 square miles surrounding Bristol Bay. The report says mining could block streams and reduce water quality. Road development and waste storage facilities could destroy habitat. Just to be clear, though, the mining companies have not yet submitted an application for a permit to mine. Mike Heatwell is a spokesman for the Pebble Partnership, which represents the mining companies interested in Bristol Bay.
For such an important subject to be rushing through a study when there is no permit application and full information in front of an agency is of extreme concern to us, and we're not alone in that.
The Alaska Attorney General wrote a letter to the EPA saying that the agency's review is, quote, unlawfully preemptive, arbitrary, capricious, and vague. The letter also said the state will explore all available legal options if the EPA tries to exert any authority under the Clean Water Act. Dennis McLaren is the head of EPA Region 10, which includes Alaska and the Northwest. He says the EPA has not made any decisions about regulatory action on Pebble Mine. Right now, they're gathering information.
We think we have very clear authority to do science and study watersheds, and we've used that extensively around the country. So any discussion about regulatory authority is something that really should come later down the road.
The EPA will hold public hearings about the report in Seattle and Alaska. The Pebble Partnership is in the process of finalizing plans for the mine and could submit a permit application by the end of the year. Bristol Bay opens for salmon fishing on Friday. I'm Ashley Ahern in Seattle.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ben Matheson in Nome, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shaylin Cochran on the Nanilchik River, and Ashley Ahern in Seattle. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.